What's the first word that comes to mind when I say economics? I'm betting it's not tasty or delicious, is it? Well, that might change after you listen to these five big ideas from Edible Economics, A Hungry Economist Explains the World by Ha-Joon Chang. Ha-Joon is a professor of economics and author of the best-selling book, 23 Things They Don't Tell You About Capitalism. In his new book, Ha-Joon uses the food on his plate to tell the story of international trade and to imagine a more varied economic menu than the one offered by free market capital. Here he is.
Hi, my name is Ha-Joon Chang. I'm a professor of economics at the University of London in England. I have a new book out called Edible Economics, subtitled A Hungry Economist Explains the World. And I want to share five insights from it with you today. Insight number one, everyone needs to learn economics. A lot of people think economics is boring, difficult stuff, and it is for professional economists only. However, we all need to learn at least some economics because in a capitalist society, nothing is free from economics. Not just your jobs, mortgage payments, and taxes, but also libraries, the teaching of ancient languages in universities, or preservation of cultural heritage. I have even met some British people who are trying to justify the monarchy in terms of the tourist revenue it allegedly generates. I'm not a monarchist, but what a demeaning way to defend an institution that you think is at the foundation of your society. So, in a capitalist society, democracy is meaningless unless every citizen knows at least some economics. Otherwise, voting in elections become like a voting in a talent show. I remember a lot of Americans voting for George W. Bush in the 2000 election, saying that he looks like a guy who I could have a beer with. Well, what a criterion to elect someone for the most powerful political office in the world. Now, having told you that we all need to learn economics, I realize that many people find economics too dry, too complicated. But that's where my book comes in. Insight number two, economics is not that difficult. A lot of people think economics is beyond them, but this is not right. In my previous book, 23 Things They Don't Tell You About Capitalism, I stuck my neck out and said 90% of economics is common sense made to look difficult with the help of jargons, math, and statistics. I also said that even the remaining 5% can be understood in their essence if explained well. I believe that anyone with a secondary school education can understand most of economics. In my book, you will find that apparently complicated economic subjects like international trade, automation, inequality, and climate change are all understandable in their essence if they're explained in a user-friendly way. Insight number three. Talking about food is a nice way to get interested in economics. Now, however user-friendly the explanations in my book are, many people don't feel motivated to learn about economics because they find the subject rather dull. So in my new book, I try to bribe my potential readers into learning and thinking about economics by wrapping dry economic arguments in succulent food stories. You know, food is so fundamental to our survival, identity, and happiness that most people are interested in food. So talking about food is a natural way to draw people in, especially if you want to eventually talk about things that people think are boring, like economics. Each chapter of my book is named after a food item. Coconut, okra, chocolate, garlic, chili, you name it. And starts with some stories about that food item. But before you know it, the food stories are somehow transformed into economic stories through what I call the Simpsons approach to writing. You know, all Simpsons episodes start with a short, wacky opening story, perhaps 30 seconds, perhaps 1 minute, usually involving Bart Simpson. Now, that story may turn out to be crucial for the main story in the episode, but it may prove to be totally irrelevant to it. It's that kind of storytelling. Insight number four, my food stories tell you that having a more open mind towards diversity is the best way to have a more interesting and healthier diet. The food stories in the book are diverse. Sometimes they're about the origin and the spreading of the food item in question, often through economic processes like global trade, migration, slavery, and colonialism. Sometimes these stories are about the significance of the food item in some culture or some historical events. Or they could even be my personal relationship with that food item. However, one thing that emerges from all these stories is that a diverse food culture based on an open mind to new things and experimentation is what makes our culinary life interesting and healthy. The best illustration is told in the book through my own experience of the changes in British food culture. In 1986, I moved from my native South Korea to Britain to do my graduate studies. At the time, food in Britain was awful. Everything was overcooked and bland. People are afraid of new things. They refused to eat what they considered foreign food. At least for me, the British food scene in the 80s was epitomized by this pizza restaurant chain called Pizza Land, which offered its customers an option to have their pizzas topped with a baked potato, in case they needed a security blanket in coping with foreign food like pizza. Today, the British food scene is totally different. It has become one of the most diverse and exciting places to eat in the world. How did this great transformation happen? My theory is that sometime in the late 1990s, British people had a collective epiphany that their food sucks. Once they gave up their own food, they opened their mind to everything. Now, there was no reason for them to favor Mexican over Korean or Italian over Ethiopian. In other words, by having an open mind, British people have achieved one of the greatest culinary transformations for the better in human history. Insight number 5. There are different ways of doing economics, all with strengths and weaknesses. So from the 1990s, my food universe was rapidly expanding, partly because of the British culinary revolution, but also because I started to get exposed to many different culinary traditions due to my travel to developing countries for my work. I'm what they call a development economist. While this was happening, unfortunately, my other universe, that is the universe of economics, was being sucked into a black hole. Until the 1970s, the world of economics resembled today's food scene in Britain. There were several different schools of economics, each of them being proud of their own heritage, by having to compete with each other, learn from each other, and even create fusion theories. Unfortunately, from the 1980s, one school of economics, known as the neoclassical school, has become completely dominant, making the intellectual scene in economics like the food scene in Britain before the 1990s. Lacking in diversity and being stagnant from lack of competition and lack of opportunities for fusion. I'm not saying that neoclassical economics is particularly bad. Like all other schools of economics, it was built to explain particular things on the basis of certain ethical and political premises. So it is very good at some things, but very bad at other things. What is a problem is the almost total dominance of one school. This has limited the scope of economics and created theoretical biases. For example, neoclassical economics regards self-seeking as the most important, if not the only, aspect of human nature. So, with the dominance of neoclassical economics, self-seeking behavior has become normalized. People who act in an altruistic way are derided as suckers or are suspected of having selfish ulterior motives. But behavioralist or institutionalist economic theories would tell you that human beings have complex motivations, of which self-serving is only one of many. For another example, neoclassical economics stasis analysis, after taking the existing distribution of income, wealth, and power as given, so it is inherently bad at challenging the status quo. So, economics is now playing the role of Catholic theology in medieval Europe. It has become a doctrine that tells people that things are what they are because they have to be, however unjust and wasteful they may look. In the same way in which the country's refusal to accept diverse culinary traditions made Britain before the 1990s a place with boring and unhealthy diet, the dominance of economics by one school has made economics limited in its coverage and narrow in its ethical foundation. There are many different ways of doing economics, and our understanding of the economic world will become so much better if all the diverse ways of thinking about the economy coexist, interact with each other, and learn from each other. Thank you for listening.
Thank you, Ha-Joon. That was Ha-Joon Chang with five big ideas from Edible Economics, A Hungry Economist Explains the World. You might also like our book bite for Dinner in Rome, A History of the World in One Meal by Andreas Vistad. I'm Rufus Griscom. Thanks for listening.